Daniel stood Stoffel and his client a drink in the bar of the Ridgeway Hotel, then excused himself and went to the reception desk to check in. He was given a room overlooking the swimming pool and went to shower away the grime and exhaustion of the past 24 hours. Then he reached for the phone and called the British High Commission. He caught the telephonist there before the close of the day's business. May I speak to Mr. Michael Hargreave, please? He held his breath. Mike Hargreave had still been in Lusaka 2 years previously, but he could have been transferred anywhere in the world by now. I am putting you through to Mr. Hargreave, the girl replied after a few moments, and Daniel let his breath out. Mike Hargreave speaking. Mike, it's Danny Armstrong. Good Lord, Danny, where are you? I'm here in Lusaka. Welcome back to Fairyland. How are you? Mike, can I see you? I need another favour. Why did you come to dinner tonight? Wendy will be charmed. Michael had one of the diplomatic residences on Nobbs Hill, within walking distance of Government House. As with every other house in the street, it was fortified like the Maze Prison. The 10-foot perimeter walls were topped and rolled with barbed wire, and two Malondo night watchmen guarded the gate. Michael Hargreave quieted his pair of Rottweiler guard dogs and greeted Daniel enthusiastically. "You aren't taking any chances, Mike," Daniel gestured towards the security precautions, and Michael grimaced. "On this street alone we average one break-in a night, despite the wire and dogs." He led Daniel into the house, and Wendy came to kiss him. Wendy was a rosebud, with soft blonde hair and one of those incredible English complexions. "I had forgotten that you are even more handsome in the flesh than on television," she smiled at him. Michael Hargreave resembled an Oxford Don more than a spook. But he was indeed an MI6 man. He and Daniel had first met in Rhodesia towards the end of the war. At the time, Daniel had been sick and dispirited, with what he'd come to realise was not only a lost cause, but an unjust one. The breaking point had come when Daniel led a column of the Salus scouts into the neighbouring state of Mozambique. The target was a guerrilla camp. Rhodesian intelligence had told them it was a training camp for Zanla recruits. But when they hit the cluster of huts, they found mostly old women and children and men. There had been almost 500 of these unfortunate people. They had left none of them alive. On the return march, Daniel had found himself weeping uncontrollably as he staggered along in the darkness. Years of ever-present danger and endless call-up for active service had worn his nerves thin and brittle. Only much later Daniel realised that he had suffered a breakdown, but at that critical moment he was approached by the clandestine Alpha Group. The war had dragged on for so many years that a small group of police and army officers had come to realise the futility of it all. Even more, they had realised that they were on the side not of the angels, but of the devil himself. They decided that they must strive for an end to the bitter civil war, that they must force the white supremacist Smith government to accept a truce negotiated by Great Britain and thereafter agree to a democratic and free election and the process of national reconciliation between the races. All the members of the Alpha Group were men whom Daniel admired. Many were senior officers, and most of them had been decorated for their courage and leadership. Daniel was drawn irresistibly to them. Michael Hargreave had been the head of station for British intelligence in Rhodesia. They had first met once Daniel had committed himself to the Alpha Group. They had worked together closely, and Daniel had played a minor role in the process that finally led to the end of those dreadful sufferings and excesses, and that culminated in the Lancaster House Agreement. Daniel had not been in Zimbabwe when Ian Smith's white regime finally capitulated. His disloyalty had been discovered by Rhodesian intelligence. Warned of his impending arrest by other members of his group, Daniel had fled the country. Had he been captured, he would certainly have faced a firing squad. He had only dared return once the country had changed its name to Zimbabwe, and the new order, led by Robert Mugabe, had come to power. When first he had met him, Daniel's relationship with Michael had been detached and professional, but mutual respect and trust had finally transformed it into a genuine friendship which had survived the years. Michael poured him a whiskey, and they chatted and reminisced until Wendy called them to the dinner table. Home cooking was a treat for Daniel, and Wendy glowed with gratification at his performance with knife and fork. With the brandy, Michael asked, "So, what about this favour?" "Two favours, actually. Gosh, runaway inflation. Speak up, my lad. Could you possibly arrange to have my film tapes sent back to London in the diplomatic bag? They are more valuable than life itself. I wouldn't trust them to the Zambian post office. Oh, that's an easy one, Michael nodded. I'll get them away in tomorrow's bag. What about the other favour? I need some information on a gentleman named Ning Cheng Gong. Are we likely to know him? Michael asked. You should. He's Taiwan's ambassador to Harare. In that case, we will certainly have a file on him. Is he friend or foe, Danny? Well, I'm not sure, not at this stage, anyway. Well, don't tell me, then. Michael sighed and pushed the brandy decanter across to Daniel. I should have a computer printout for you before noon tomorrow. Shall I send it around to the Ridgeway? Bless you, old son, I owe you another one. And don't you forget it, Danny boy. It was an enormous relief to get rid of the tapes that Jock had shot. They represented a grueling year's labour and almost Daniel's entire worldly wealth. He believed so strongly in this new project that he had decided that, contrary to his usual practice, he would not seek outside financing. He had put everything he owned at risk, almost $500,000 that he had painfully accumulated over the last 10 years, since he had become a full-time author and television producer. So Daniel's tapes went out the following morning with the diplomatic courier on the British Airways flight and would be in London within 12 hours. Daniel had consigned them to Castle Studios, where they would be in safekeeping until he could begin the editorial work to transform it into another one of his productions. He had almost settled on a title for the series. Is Africa Dying? Rather than entrust it to a messenger, Michael Hargreave personally delivered the computer printout on Ning Cheng Gong to Daniel at the hotel. Nice lad you've picked on, he commented. I haven't read it all, just enough to find out that the Ning family is not one to be trifled with. Take it easy, Danny. These are big boys. He handed over the sealed envelope. Just one condition. As soon as you've read it, I want you to burn it. Do I have your word on that? Daniel nodded in agreement, and Michael went on. I brought along an askari from the High Commission to guard your Land Cruiser for you. You daren't leave a vehicle untended on the street, not in Lusaka. Daniel took the envelope up to his hotel room and ordered a pot of tea. When it arrived, he locked the door, stripped to his underpants, and lay on the bed. The printout ran to 11 pages, all of them fascinating. Johnny Inzu had given him only an inkling of the wealth and importance of the Ning family. Ning Heng Hisui was the patriarch. His holdings were so diversified and cross-pollinated with international companies and offshore holdings in Luxembourg, Geneva and Jersey that the author of the report admitted laconically at the end of this section, "List of holdings probably incomplete." Going over the data more attentively, Daniel thought he perceived a subtle shift in investment emphasis dating from about the time of Ning Cheng Gong's appointment to his ambassadorial post in Africa. Although the Ning family holdings were still centred on the Pacific Rim, the investments in Africa and in Africa-based companies had risen to a significant percentage of the entire portfolio. In turning the page, he discovered that the computer had analysed this and determined that within 6 years the African section had increased from zero to just under 12% of the total. There were large holdings in South African mining conglomerates and in African land and food production companies, and even larger holdings in forestry estates, paper pulp mills, and cattle and sheep ranches, all in Africa, south of the Sahara. It didn't take any clairvoyant gift to surmise that Ning Cheng Gong had pointed the family in this direction. On page 4 of the computer printout, Daniel read that Ning Cheng Gong was married to a Chinese girl from another rich Taiwanese family. The marriage had been arranged by the respective families. The couple had 2 children, a son born in 1982 and a daughter in 1983. Cheng's interests were listed as Oriental music and theatre and collecting Oriental art, especially jade and ivory artefacts. He was an acknowledged expert on ivory netsuka. He played golf and tennis and sailed. He was also an expert in the martial arts, having reached the 4th Dan. He smoked moderately and drank alcohol socially. He did not use any type of narcotic, and the only weakness which the report suggested might be used as leverage or influence was that Ning Cheng Gong regularly patronised the high-class brothels of Taipei. His special sexual tastes seemed to lean towards acting out elaborate fantasies of an overtly sadistic nature. In 1987, one of the brothel girls had died during one of these performances. The family had obviously been able to quell any scandal, for no charges were ever brought against Cheng.
Well, Mike was right, Daniel conceded as he laid aside the printout. He is a big boy and well protected. Best take it one careful step at a time. Chetty Singh first. If I can establish a connection, that might be the key.
As he dressed for dinner, he kept turning the pages of the report on the dressing table to make certain that he had not overlooked any connection with Malawi or with Chetty Singh. There was none, and he went down to dinner feeling depressed and discouraged. The role he had chosen for himself as Johnny Inzu's Avenger was daunting. There were both smoked Scotch salmon and roast sirloin of milk-fed Charolais beef on the 5-page menu. However, when he ordered these, the waiter shook his head regretfully.
Sorry, not got.
It swiftly developed into a guessing game.
Sorry, no got.
The waiter looked genuinely distressed as Daniel worked his way unsuccessfully through the menu, until Daniel noticed that everyone else in the dining room was eating stringy roast chicken and rice.
Yes, got chicken and rice, the waiter beamed approval. What do you want for dessert?
By now, Daniel had learned the trick. He checked the other tables.
Well, how about banana custard?
The waiter shook his head.
Not got.
But Daniel could tell by his expression that he was getting warm. Daniel stood up and crossed to a Nigerian businessman at the next table.
Excuse me, sir, what is that you're eating?
He returned to his own table.
I'll have banana delight, he said,
and the waiter nodded happily.
Yes, tonight we've got banana delight.
This little comedy restored Daniel's good humour and sense of the ridiculous.
AWA, Daniel reassured him. Africa wins again.
And the waiter looked delighted at such obvious praise and encouragement. The next morning, Daniel headed eastwards towards Chipata and the Malawi border. There was not much point in expecting a sustaining breakfast from the hotel, and anyway he was away long before the kitchens opened. He had covered almost 100 miles before the sun rose, and he kept going most of the day, stopping only to eat beside the road. He reached the border the following morning, and crossed into Malawi with a lightening of his spirits. Not only was this tiny country even more spectacularly beautiful than the one he was leaving, but in comparison the mood of its people was contented and carefree. Malawi was known as the Switzerland of Africa for its grand mountains and highland plateaus, and its lakes and lovely rivers. Its people were famous throughout the southern continent for their intelligence and adaptability. They were sought after at every level of employment, from domestic servants to miners and industrial workers. Lacking viable mineral deposits, Malawi's most valuable asset and export were her people. Under the benevolent despotism of their octogenarian president for life, the special talents and strengths of the Malawian people were encouraged and fostered. The rural areas were not neglected, and the urban migration was checked. Each family was ordered by the leader to build its own home and make itself self-sufficient in food. As cash crops, they grew cotton and groundnuts. On the large mountainside estates, they raised a superior leaf of tea. As Daniel drove towards the capital, Lilongwe, the contrast with the country he had just left was striking. The villages he passed were clean and orderly and prosperous. The people on the roadside were sleek, well-dressed and smiling. Most of the handsome women favoured a full-length skirt printed with the national colours and a portrait of Kamuzu, Hastings Banda, the president. Short skirts were forbidden in Malawi by presidential decree, as was long hair on men. Along the roadside, food and carved wooden curios were offered for sale. It was strange to see a surplus of food in any African country. Daniel stopped to buy eggs and oranges, mandarins, luscious red tomatoes, and roasted groundnuts, and also to exchange cheerful banter with the vendors. After the misery and deprivation he had witnessed in the country he had so recently left, his mood was uplifted by these delightful people. Given the circumstances to make a good life, there are few peoples on earth so friendly and charming as those of Africa. Daniel found his regard for them strengthened and renewed. "If you don't like black people, then you shouldn't be living in Africa," Daniel's father had once said to him. It was a remark that had remained in his memory all these years, the validity of it growing ever more evident. As he approached Lilongwe, Daniel was struck even more forcefully by the contrast with the other capitals of the continent. It was a recent capital, planned and built with architectural advice and financial help from South Africa. There was no slum stench here. Instead, it was a pretty town, modern and functional. Daniel found it good to be back again. The Capital Hotel was surrounded by parks and lawns, but conveniently situated close to the centre of the town. As soon as he was alone in his room, Daniel checked the local telephone directory, which he found in the bedside drawer. Chetty Singh was a big man in town and obviously enjoyed the sound of his own name. There was a string of numbers listed. He seemed to have his fingers in every honeypot. Chetty Singh Fisheries, Chetty Singh Supermarkets, Chetty Singh Tannery, Chetty Singh Sawmills and Lumber, Chetty Singh Garages and Toyota Agency. The list took up half the page. Not a difficult bird to point, Daniel admitted to himself. Now let's see if we can get him to flush for a good sporting shot. While he shaved and showered, an attentive room servant carted his travel-stained clothing off to the laundry and ironed a clean but crumpled bush jacket to starchy perfection. Good excuse. I need to restock the tucker box, Daniel told himself as he went downstairs, and asked the receptionist directions to Chetty Singh's supermarket. Across the park, the man pointed. With assumed nonchalance, Daniel sauntered across the park. It occurred to him that he was hardly the most inconspicuous visitor in town, with his London-tailored bush jacket, silk scarf, and the spectacularly travel-dusted and battered Land Cruiser with its strong-arm motif emblazoned all over it. Let's pray that Chetty Singh never got a good look at me or the truck that night. Chetty Singh's supermarket was on Main Street in a new four-story building of modern layout with clean tiled floors and walls. The shelves were piled with abundant wares, all reasonably priced, and the premises were thronged with customers. In Africa, this was unusual. While Daniel joined the relays of housewives wheeling their shopping trolleys down the aisles between the shelves, he was studying the building and its staff. Four young Asian girls sat at the cash registers guarding the exit. They were quick and efficient. Under their graceful brown fingers, the registers tinkled to the sweet music of Mammon. Chetty Singh's daughters, Daniel guessed, as he noted the family resemblance. They were pretty as sunbirds in their brightly coloured saris. In the centre of the floor, a middle-aged Asian lady sat at a tall dais from which she could keep a beady eye on every corner of the shop. She wore her hair in an iron-grey plait, and though her sari was more subdued in colour, it was edged with gold thread, and the diamonds on her fingers ranged from the size of peas to sparrows' eggs. Mama Singh, Daniel decided. When it came to handling the cash, Asian businessmen liked to keep it close to home, which was probably one of the reasons for their universal success. He took his time selecting groceries, hoping for a glimpse of his quarry, but there was no sign of the turbaned Sikh. At last, Mama Singh left her seat on the dais and made an elephantine but dignified progress down the length of the store, until, with her long silken sari sweeping the treads, she mounted a flight of stairs set so discreetly in a corner of the food hall that Daniel had not noticed them before. She entered a door at a higher level, and now Daniel noticed a mirrored window in the wall beside the elevated door. It was obviously a one-way glass. An observer in the room beyond the door would have a clear view over the supermarket floor, and Daniel had no doubt that that was Chetty Singh's office. He turned away from that inscrutable square of glass, aware that he might have been under observation for the past half hour, and that the precaution was probably too late. He made his way to one of the girls at the cash registers, and while she totted up his purchases, he kept his face averted from the window in the rear wall.